As is our custom, we open the meeting with a reading of this document called the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. To wit, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. This little pamphlet has a list of schedules of our meetings. For instance, this morning, the doors opened at 10:30, and we began promptly at 11. Let out at noon. February is almost over. However, today being the 21st, the topic is self-sacrifice that does not harm. And for the month of February, it was all about the facets of self-discipline. Our study classes on Wednesday night begins at 7:30 and is out by 8:30. The doors open at 5:15, so you can come in and visit our library. It's a reference library, and you'll find in there topics for that particular evening and many more interesting books, pamphlets, and you can talk to the volunteer at the library desk, and also here in the middle room, you'll find someone at the desk to answer your questions. That covers it, but we would still want you to remember this note. The purpose: to spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. Before we begin this morning's program, we would like to give you this collation from the Voice of the Silence to give thought, contemplation, concentration, and meditation. Sow kindly acts, and thou shalt reap their fruition. Inaction in a deed of mercy becomes an action in a deadly sin. Thus saith the sage. Shalt thou abstain from action? Not so shall gain thy soul her freedom. Self-knowledge is of loving deeds, the child. Believe thou not that sitting in dark forests in proud seclusion and apart from men will lead thee to the goal. Think not that breaking bone, that rending flesh and muscle, unites thee to thy silent self. Think not that when the sins of thy gross form are conquered, thy duty is accomplished by nature and by man. The blessed ones have scorned to do so. The blessed ones have scorned to do so.
It does seem an odd title this morning, doesn't it? When we are told self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child. Obviously, loving deeds is what we should be doing. But then we come across this title with a warning. They should do no harm. Well, what kind of harm can self-knowledge, loving deeds, self-sacrifice do? Always, within any study, you have to go back to the basics to begin with, to be certain that you have a foundation for what you're considering. And the foundation for these studies are, well, it's a triangle. It's three basic principles. And one is that this entire universe, visible and invisible, is based upon an absolute universal principle. And since that is the established basis, everything, visible or invisible, and everyone is all part and parcel of one and the same life, spirit, consciousness, however you want to put it into words, it is the fact that this is a divine expression, and we call it life. But life is even where we can't picture or imagine it. So first we have to have that premise, that it is universal brotherhood as a fact, not as a utopian dream, as a fact. And the second is that this is a universe of law. Not chance, not miracle. It is everywhere in every religion depicted in one way or another. In Christianity, it has been reduced to a God idea that God makes those laws and acts on them. But Theosophy says, no, we ourselves are that expression. That everything that we have, good, bad, or indifferent, comes from our own use of life in this life and in past lives. In setting up causes, we must reap their effect eventually. And that third idea is that it is evolution, growth from within outwards. There's nothing imposing on us that hasn't come from our own use of the power of life, of consciousness, of self-consciousness. So having that established, how does self-sacrifice come in? And why does self-sacrifice come in? Well, we have to go back to that first idea. The entire universe is an expression of brotherhood, of sacrifice, of community, however you want to express it to yourself. Spend one day thinking like that, realizing that the sidewalk you step on, oh, well, somebody had to make that. Somebody had to put their energy into that. Hey, somebody had to pay for that. And spend the entire day reflecting how everything that you go to do is based upon a brotherhood of effort, a community of love and service. Now, we might say, oh, well, people got paid for that. That doesn't change the fact that they put their heart and soul into the doing of whatever it is. So we have a reflection here on earth of what is divine. Everything is sacrificing in one way or another for the good of someone or something else. Well, then it must be a very basic thing. But then when we start to delve into the subject, we read two statements by HPB in the Key to Theosophy that truly give you pause. The first is, it is not by studying occultism for selfish ends, for the gratification of one's personal ambition, pride, or vanity, that one can ever reach the true goal. And what is the true goal of any one of us? Helping suffering humanity. How many of us have ever thought that? I'm here to help humanity. That's why I'm here. The things I learn, I'm learning so that I can share with suffering humanity. It's quite a difference from the way we have all premised our lives. This is why we're here. Theosophy would remind us we are spiritual beings using physical bodies, personal lives, in order to acquire wisdom, in order to share it and use it and be part of that community. But then there is this in the same publication, The Key to Theosophy. Duty is that which is due to humanity, to our fellow men, neighbors, family, and especially that which we owe to all those who are poorer and more helpless than we are ourselves. This is a debt which, if left unpaid during life, leaves us spiritually insolvent and morally bankrupt in our next incarnation. Theosophy is the quintessence of duty. Having that to realize that if we don't live up to our duty, we will be morally bankrupt, indebted when we return in our next incarnation. We better learn very quickly and very well what is true self-sacrifice. So we have some few statements that help us in that. The highest standard, we are told, is giving of oneself, giving others more than we give to ourselves, being ready to sacrifice. In our attempt to learn and study, it should be not for our improvement, but for our ability to sow seeds that will help others and help life. But what about that duty we have to ourselves? How do we follow that? To control and conquer through the realization that the higher self is identical in each, to control and conquer our own lower personal self, which we have built up through choices we've made, through our own will, through our own actions and desires. So we have to begin to control that from a higher basis, because we have, and we all know it, we have two minds. We have a lower mind that rushes after this or that impulse. We have a higher mind that is quiet and spiritual and steadfast and will look to the higher for advice. The storm comes between those two. And every time we give up the lower for the higher, we have strengthened that connection. Our object is to have that lower completely in our control. To purify himself inwardly and morally, to fear no one and nothing, save the tribunal of one's own conscience. Never to do a thing by halves. If you think it's the right thing to do, do it boldly and openly. If it's wrong, don't touch it at all. Now that's our duty to ourselves. Now, when it comes to harm, we have to consider what are the basic self-sacrifices we might make. Well, as a parent or a friend, we might be anxious to help, let's say with a child. The problem is there are people who do their children's homework and then wonder why the child isn't making strides. We've actually seen competitions where a science project was done completely by the parent and it didn't come out until the child had won. The tragedy of that is not that the parent wants to do so much, but that they're stealing from the opportunity for learning and growth of the child. And there are parents that go the opposite way, that make everything so rigid and so difficult that the child is like oppressed by that. In either case, it harms. A parent, a friend, a coworker is supposed to be there to aid and assist, to remind us of another way to do something, or even to encourage us to act on our ideas and learn for ourselves. Well, that's going to fail. So it's harmful to be too concerned about another human being, so concerned that we step in and take over for them. But there's another harm. Because we don't even know our own karma, to know and see the karma of another is practically impossible. So you may step in with a great solution for somebody in trouble, and you have totally prevented their ability to learn and grow from facing the results of their own actions. You can't just assume that you can fix anything for anybody. If you recall in the Bible, there were times that Jesus was said to have not healed, that it was something that should be let to develop, to allow that soul to experience that. So in order to do good, to have it be real self-sacrifice, we have to have knowledge. We have to have wisdom. Does that mean, though, if we are in a situation and we know we don't have enough knowledge or wisdom, that we should ignore it and not help someone? As we heard in the earlier reading, inaction in a deed of mercy is a deadly sin. As far as we know, that's the only place in the entire philosophy that uses the word sin. So it's obviously very important. So if you see something and you know you're not wise enough, you can either call on somebody else that has more wisdom, or you can just offer to help and then see what the other needs. It's a huge, complicated lesson we all have to learn, and it's not going to happen overnight. Obviously, we've been at this work for a very long time. HPV wrote this, and we would remind you, we have put out at the book table a compendium of some of these quotes, because we think it helps to have something to turn to remind you of an idea. She said, "He who does not practice altruism, he who is not prepared to share his last morsel with a weaker or poorer than himself, he who neglects to help his brother man of whatever race, nation, or creed, whenever and wherever he meets suffering, and who turns a deaf ear to the cry of human misery, he who hears an innocent person slandered, whether a brother theosophist or not, and does not undertake his defense as he would undertake his own, is no theosophist." But when it comes to working on ourselves at the same time we're trying to participate wisely in life, we get a mistaken notion about what we're supposed to do about our lower personal nature. Some people stamp it down completely and pretend it no longer exists. Well, they should be aware that it will blow up on them sooner or later. It is a tool. It is a workbook. It includes lessons that we have to learn. We can't ignore it. But it isn't that it has to be destroyed. It is the higher nature that is to begin to take over the lower personal nature. And that can only be by observation. And one of the biggest sacrifices we have to make is the time that we usually spend frivolously. Maybe watching something stupid on television or, you know, whatever it is, we can find some time during the day to sit down and literally review our own personal nature, not with shame or guilt, but, oh, this is the car I'm driving. It's beat up and it's not working well, and what's wrong? And then begin to review how you act during the day. Do you treat certain people in a certain way and others in a different way? Why? You begin to try to study and discover the secrets and tricks of your own lower nature, because it is tricky, because it is intelligent, and it is alive, and it's been set to act in certain ways by us. As anyone knows who's tried to conquer any habit, it is not easy. But we begin by observation. We're not trying to change it. We're trying to see how it works. Gradually, if we keep it up, because our biggest obstacle in this is we're not stupid, we're lazy. We would rather go along with a problem than face it and alter it. We won't take control of our own minds. And if we're going to gain that kind of self-knowledge, we have to make a great effort. Little by little, but a great effort. Again, quoting HPV, self-knowledge of this kind is unattainable by what men usually call self-analysis. It is the awakening to consciousness of the divine nature of man. And that means we need to study higher ideas, we need to meditate, we need to work on what we carry around in our own minds daily. And she ends with, to obtain this knowledge is a greater achievement than to command the elements or to know the future. Because once you know yourself, you know the universe, you know the divine. So we're sure we have skirted many issues that you were curious about, but the more we read, the more we thought, the bigger this became. So your questions are invited. Yes?
You made a statement saying if something comes to us, if we can see that it's not the right thing to do, we don't do it or we don't touch it. If we see it's the right thing to do, we get involved. Well, for some people, just that first step of making the judgment, is this right or wrong?
Well, we think that's a very good point. And if that's our problem, that's where we start working. We have to set up, literally, criteria for ourselves. What's a right action? What's a wrong action? We can go through some of them, and they're very, very easy. But if we can't get a really good idea, turn to the Buddha. What does the Buddha say? Kill nothing, harm nothing. Go through the various injunctions that are given to you. If you still can't decide, you can ask yourself, would this act of mine truly benefit the other? Then whether I know enough, I'm going to do my best and learn from it. The problem is usually when we make mistakes, we run the other way. We don't want to learn from it. We want to forget it ever happened. So it becomes useless to us. So if you cannot decide, just go for the highest you can imagine. There are many times when you should say no. We recall an older student saying to us once, it was very kind of you to do all that for that other person, but you do realize they are no closer to knowing how to do it for themselves. So we sometimes impede other people. You had your hand up?
Well, yes. You know, we live on the plane of effects.
Mm-hmm.
So the causes are rooted within the ideas that we hold to be true. So to begin being good, we have to understand ourselves, and we have to begin there. In reference to this talk this morning, the Bhagavad Gita is like the pathway to all of this, that is a constant reminder of how we need to think. So I just wanted to...
Yeah, every devotional book is a pathway and appeals to different natures. The beauty of the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna as the elder, whether you see him as the elder student or the divine being, takes Arjuna, ourselves, the one in conflict and confusion, and leads him step by step, building that foundation of those ideas that will hold the rest of the teaching. And he tells him that as a warrior, as a fighter, he has no choice. And that is true of all of us. If we are interested in these ideas, if we're attracted to them, we have reached a point in our own evolution where we have no choice. We have to begin to use these ideas to make them alive. So Arjuna learns that the only way to properly act is to give up all personal interest in the result of action. So you go back to the earlier question, I don't know if I should do this or I shouldn't do this. The first thing you have to do is, I am not looking for anything to come to me. Not thank you, not gratitude, not a good feeling for myself. I am looking to do my best for the other and let it go at that. So if one takes the Gita and begins walking that path step by step, they can't help but gain wisdom, not just about themselves, but about life. Yes?
We think, and perhaps that's what the previous speaker meant, discrimination has to be developed because we had a friend years ago who was being abused and we kept trying to help her, and every time we did, she got more punishment from him and we couldn't understand it. And finally we realized we need discrimination here. And ultimately it worked out. He went to jail, spent his time, reformed, you know, taught while he was in there. And he's out now and he's a different person. But the trauma that she went through, partially because of my action,
I don't quite understand that. Do you mean that she was repeating whatever you said to him and that caused a problem? I don't understand.
If he found out that she had come to me for help, he would worsen the punishment.
I understand that part of it, but I don't think that required discrimination on your part. You couldn't know that ahead of time. Yes, we have to get all the facts that we can, but after we have and we're determined to act on something, we act and accept the results. But to build discrimination, how do we do that?
Practice.
Yes.
Trial and error.
Trial and error.
Hoping not to kill kill with kindness.
And taking notes, even if they're just mental notes. There's no point in our experiences if we just experience them and let them go. We have to build on them. We have to learn from it. You know, it's so funny. We know that about things we're really interested in. You know, whether it's cooking or basketball or whatever it is, we have built up a knowledge and an awareness and a discrimination about it because we wanted to, because we were interested in it. So we have to get interested in this and build up a hunger for it. Yes.
How about developing our intuition as to whether, in regards to discrimination,
mm-hmm. It's the very same effort. You have to act on an intuition that you've thought about and really tried to understand. Act on it and then keep the results. And keeping the results, you then look. All right, let's say it blew up in your face. How was I prejudiced so that I didn't even see that? What was I thinking? How personal did I make this? And that's the only way that you will ever learn to trust your intuition, is if you inspect the results. Yes?
Recently had the experience where two companions immediately came to the same conclusion about something, almost reflexively, intuitively, whereas I would have needed more time to consider possibilities of what to do. Is there a right or a wrong path? I mean, when two others so quickly come to a decision and I'm just beginning to contemplate.
Two or 2,000 others cannot come to a conclusion for you unless you're lazy. That's the problem. People get swayed by other people's intuition or opinion. We have the right to take all the time it takes for ourselves to weigh and consider. Even if the others are right and you're wrong, you still have to go by what you think and what you know. Theosophy is not a belief. Believing in something is the starting point. You have to trust something if you're going to investigate it. Believing in something will not take you to wisdom. You have to act on that belief or idea. So it doesn't matter how many others agreed. Yes?
You said before that we study these principles, these ideas, so we can apply them in our lives, control our lower nature. We recall HBB saying in one context, though, that a human being should not sacrifice themselves wholly for a principle or a higher principle. What did she mean by that? What is the potential waste or problem of that?
Well, the only one that I can think of, so perhaps you'll follow through on this, is where she said you should never starve yourself by feeding someone else so that you die and the other goes on, unless you know that they're going to be more valuable to life than you are. But that's the only thing we can recall.
Well, it was in that context. We think it was the idea not to throw one's life away or sacrifice oneself without knowing that there was a definite
end in view
for a human being or for humanity, not just for an abstract, what one believed was an abstract cause, but it should be for, obviously, for example,
for a real purpose.
For example, Father Damien.
Yes.
He was not sacrificing his life just for a principle or for his own beliefs, but rather he willingly did it in order to benefit those that were suffering.
If no one knows, Father Damien was a Catholic priest who was sent on a temporary appointment that many, many others had been sent on. They usually only lasted a few months, onto an island in Hawaii where there wasn't even a landing place. You were thrown into the water and you had to make it to the island. And the island housed all the people with leprosy. And they were just literally dumped there. But every few months, a priest would show up. Father Damien was appalled, and he organized them to he created a school so they could learn how to take care of themselves, how to help each other. He created a community, and when they came to take him back, he wouldn't go. He said, I'm going to stay with these people. And he changed their lives so completely. It went from a place of despair to a place of hope. And after quite a few number of years, in one of his sermons, he said, we lepers. And that's when everyone knew that he had contacted leprosy. But his work is such a perfect example of taking it from the abstract to the absolutely practical. Another great example is Mother Teresa. She, her whole thing in talking to people was not asking you to save the world, just help one person, just one. And that's taking it from the abstract. So we should have the principles in mind, but our basis of action is where we find ourselves, our family, our fellows, where we have placed ourselves and where life has placed us. That's where we have duties we have to fulfill. Yes.
But how do we know that although we have this feeling and we're in the right place and we recognize the duty, how do we know we're not interrupting the karma of another?
Well, that's a very, very good question. First of all, you don't jump in and solve another's problems. That is definitely interfering with their very growth. We're not wise enough to know that someone else may benefit more from suffering more. We're not wise enough. So we don't turn a cold shoulder. And, you know, that's been a problem in India. That, oh, you have that problem? Oh, it's your karma. You brought it on yourself. Well, that creates such an unbrotherliness inside yourself, it's like taking poison. So while we can't know enough, we can be there enough. How can I help you? What do you need? No, I can't do that, but I could do this. We're trying to establish a right basis that allows them to grow and learn and allows us to be helpful to them. But there are simple things. If you see somebody falling down in the street, rush to help them. Forget your own dignity or your own concern about yourself. Just help where you see a need. But if it's someone that you are close to, you should have a pretty good idea of how much karma and how much suffering they can take. Yes.
Well, if we're in line with that, if we are focused on the performance of our duties in life, and in the performance of those natural duties, we come along somebody who's suffering, we're as much part of their karma as their suffering is. It reminds us of that statement in the voice that's always puzzling, that we reincarnate with others who are chained
to our own past
actions,
yes.
That they're part of our karma too, and we are part of theirs.
And sometimes that's very hard to accept, that the friends and the difficulties we have are equal, that they all belong to us. That's why we have them. So if someone is in a difficulty and we're their friend, we're close to them, we're part of the solution. It may just be guidance or a shoulder to cry on. We have to remember, we're not here to teach each other. We're not here to fix each other. It's as simple as that. We're here as an example, yes, And sometimes it can be, that's what I don't want to do. We're examples to each other, but we're not here to fix anyone. We're here to work on ourselves, and in that effort, provide an example to others. Yes?
Well, we understood the intent of what you meant when you said we're not here to teach each other.
Right.
Fixing. Well, how is that different from the statement in the declaration to make oneself better, to help and teach others? Well, how's that kind of teaching different from the kind of teaching?
Yes. We meant teaching in the sense of preaching to someone, dictating what they should do, trying to control their thinking. True teaching is educare, bringing from within the other out what they already know, which was Socrates' method, asking the right questions to make the person realize you already know that. You're just not acting on it. So it's teaching in that sense, and that's, again, by example and by offering good food, the good food of the great teachers, Lao Tzu, the Buddha, Krishna. We have such a wealth around us, and we spend our time, it would seem, on Facebook when we should be spending our time in the real truth that's out there in the universe and published for us in black and white. It's amazing. Yes?
We're sort of still back there, a few questions behind.
That's okay.
Well, the point was made that there's, it should be stated, that we should sacrifice to the highest that we understand. And what it brought up was, in Buddhism, there are two schools, Mahayana and Hinayana.
Mm-hmm.
And one is for the self, and one is for the all. And we think that we all fall into that trap, that I know, speaking personally, that we want to develop ourselves so that we can do good for others,
right.
And then we get stuck in just developing ourselves and not really helping others. So I guess really the idea is that our heart, we have to open our heart up to the fact of that we're all the same in our very nature, and that's how we help each other. When we aren't annoyed with each other, we aren't, you know.
In the Diamond Sutra, it says, the Bodhisattva vows to save every being, but at the same time recognizes that there are no beings to be saved. We are all spiritual beings. We are all fumbling and stumbling through learning to set up better causes, learning to be kinder and gentler to each other. If we would take the focus off, I want to develop so that I can help others, and turn that focus upside down, I want to help others. I want to help life. I want to be useful. Now, obviously, I have to learn some things in order to do that, but my focus isn't on my learning. My focus is on the opportunities to come to be of service. It's a reversal of our mindset. You know, why do we think that way? Isn't that very much the Western idea? Every individual, every man for themselves, you have to do it. Isn't that the parody on the golden rule? Do for yourself before the other guy does it to you, some sort of thing like that. We're all upside down in how we think. And we have to reverse that. No one can do it for us. And that's what we mean. We're not here to teach anybody or to fix anybody. It's self-induced. It's self-devised. I have to figure out what works for me as a spiritual being in this mess I have made in my use of powers. What will help me better serve? And that's in our declaration as well. Yes?
Well, you started, or when I walked in, that we live in a society. We live in a world where cooperation has made it grow and it has become very dynamic and
mm-hmm.
in many parts of the world. And but on the opposite side of that is violence and greed and suffering. As trying to be responsible, where does our focus lie? Does it lie in ourself, or does it lie in hope, or does it lie in the fact that, gee, if they understood reincarnation and karma, perhaps they would look at life a little differently?
Perhaps. In your question was the answer. I mean, we have to begin, if we really realize who and what we are, hope is not what we think hope is. Hope is reality. There's no hoping for a beautiful future, a beautiful world, for unity, for brotherhood. It is a fact. It is distant from us in these conditions. But part of the problem is that we look at the 1 or 2, or maybe it's even 5% of misery and horror that's out there. Selfishness, greed, murder, all kinds of terrible things. But it's a very small percentage. Why is it so big on the top of our minds? Because we're saturated with it. Because it sells newspapers. Because it sells advertising on television. We recall a number of years ago, they tried having a good news broadcast. It didn't last very long. But then that's our fault. As consumers, we get what we want. We're watching it, or it wouldn't be there for us. So we have to change our focus. Put the top of your focus on the spiritual, the beautiful. How come, if this world is so terrible, the bad guys never win? They never do. They make a lot of noise, they hurt a lot of people, but they never win. It always balances back up again. How come there are flowers every year? How come there's beauty and vegetables and food to eat and things are glorious? Go out and look at the stars at night. How come we don't focus on all that beauty and we focus on the negative? So the focus shouldn't be on ourselves, but on what we can see, what we can hear, what we can learn, and what we can do.
Are you advocating turning the television off?
No, I'm advocating getting rid of it.
No.
Because if you can turn something off, you can turn it back on. No, there are wonderful things on television. The problem is, and we think you really notice it when there's a tragedy. Let something crash or burn, and you are going to see it 7 million times. It never stops happening. Well, what we don't realize is the impressions that we take in through our hearing, through our vision, become a part of our inner nature. We're electrical, magnetic beings, and those scenes stay with us. It becomes part of our character for the time. So, fine. See it once so you can understand it and know what it's about, and then do not look at it from then on. If you can find, or maybe start a television program that is like this discussion, or that is just somebody reading the Bhagavad Gita out loud, anything that will allow people to have a taste of the spiritual, of the divine, then you can have all the television you want. Do you have your hand up? Just, no? Yes.
We were considering the idea of harmony in our lives, in nature, and the fact that the greatest musicians, the greatest poets, and playwriters are honored all over the world, because their works produce something within us that is satisfying. And that's in line with the quote from the teachings about harmony and justice.
Mm-hmm.
So if they have such a great effect on the people,
Well, we saw a wonderful thing, we're guilty, of Facebook. It was a piano, and the person was playing like Grieg or something very dramatic with lots of key movement. And then there was a piano behind him, and the script on the screen said, a piano has 88 keys, and they're all different. And then he swung around to the other piano, 88 keys, and they were all the same. So he played the same piece of music, and then he came back to the normal piano. The point is that our differences are valuable, and it is only through adjusting differences you get harmony. It isn't all agreeing to sing one note and to do the same thing. If you've ever been part of a chorus, we're sure it would happen with musical instruments too, there is a point within that effort of putting out the music where you no longer exist. You don't hear yourself. All you hear is what is coming forward as a group. It's a wonderful feeling. It is a feeling that we could have ourselves. You know, it is said every night during the deep sleep state, we are one universally. We are in our real spiritual nature. We commune with each other, with the highest beings in the universe. Why? Because we are one. You know, theosophy was brought forward to humanity because of the cycle, because it was a downward going cycle of superstition, sectarianism, materialism. And it was brought by brothers, masters, initiates of the ancient wisdom religion. And they brought forth what could be given out to humanity at this time, because we are at a crisis point. And if we don't wake up, we meaning the few who are willing to listen, if we don't wake up and begin planting those seeds to help humanity, then it's going to sink even further downward. So harmony comes from within every one of us. We don't have to be a great composer or a great playwright. We just have to be a great soul and live up to our nature. Yes.
Well, we all have our favorite choral masterpieces, or maybe our favorite opera or Broadway showstoppers, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And we don't realize that we love those things not because of the melody, but because how the alto or the tenor or the bass, who you never really hear, and if you heard their parts, you would think, what is that?
Right.
It's their little contributions that add so much to the beauty of the masterpiece. The melody alone would be nothing. So we have to keep that in mind.
There are no small parts.
Are those small parts would right. seem insignificant and perhaps dull and compare, when added to the whole, just make it much more rich than mm-hmm. one thing alone.
We don't know if any of you recall, Leonard Bernstein had I think it was a Saturday afternoon TV show, and it was classics for children. And he would show that. He would have the violins do their part, and then the cellos, and then the drums, whatever. And you would hear maybe a bass, a stupid thing. It was like boom, ba-dum, boom, boom, ba-dum, boom, boom. It was just nothing. You'd think, well, that's not music. But then when they put it together, you appreciated and valued, oh, that's what that does. That ba-doom, boom, boom. And you began to realize there are no small parts. It is a symphony. But what does a symphony have that we don't have? A conductor, a coach. If we could imagine in front of ourselves, maybe not every day, maybe there are several coaches we would imagine, but to wake up in the morning and imagine that coach was with us, someone that we look up to who is spiritual, wise, kind, honest, dignified, someone that we wouldn't mind being like, and have that coach with us for the day. And literally turn to them and say, how am I doing? You know, literally, we then have a partner in this. We need a coach. We need a conductor, because we're lost right now and struggling. Yes, sir.
Don't we have many coaches already? I mean, we have writings of, or the ideas and lives of the so-called saints who came before us that we can always refer to, be it Buddha or...
Fine, but yeah. Do we refer to them? Do we refer to them intellectually?
Oh.
Or we put the picture of the Buddha up on the wall, or a little statue. That doesn't mean we're using it.
Well, I'm not speaking so much of little statues. I mean, the things that they said, they're left behind.
Yes.
For us as God.
That's right.
That's what they are. They're examples for what we can be.
Exactly. And what do we do with
they
them?
They are our conductors.
Yes.
We just have to watch and see what, or, you know, read and find out what they said.
We have to actively seek it out. We have to want it. You always get what you want, sooner or later. And that's the secret of karma as well. You will get what you want. So be careful what you want. But if you really believe that the teachings of the Buddha are worth following, follow them. And more will come to you, because that's the way life works. It's a demand system. What you demand, you will get. Put your hand up first.
Well, in the philosophy, we have the writings of a Mr. Judge. And we turn to them when we are in need of a friend. And what he says there is that, you know, that our teacher or benefactor cannot change us. Mm-hmm. They can only adjust. They can only adjust things in our nature. So by even listening to what they have written,
right,
it's simply common sense. We feel an adjustment. We don't feel a change, but we see it, gee whiz, if I had taken that attitude, I wouldn't be feeling this way, and maybe the results were not right.
Well, the funny thing about common sense is how uncommon it is these days. We listen to the words of others without trying to establish their basis. If we really feel any of these spiritual teachings are of value, we should have them in front of our mind. We should be able to call upon them. We want to end with something that is outside the usual purview. We think of self-sacrifice and compassion as just lofty ideals, something that maybe is worthwhile once in a while when I'm not busy working on myself. But then there's this from the Science Daily publication. Compassion, like physical and academic skills, appears to be something that is not fixed, but rather can be enhanced with training and practice. And the fact that alterations in brain function were observed after just a total of 7 hours of training is remarkable. 7 hours of training in methods of compassion altered the function of the brain. What is stopping us? We have all the power in the world, because we are life itself. If we want this enough, the way we want air to breathe, nothing can stand in our way. Meeting is adjourned.